From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, a view from Britain on the reality of the Brexit chaos there.
One of the things people have been talking about is toilet paper. Apparently, we don't stockpile any in this country. It's all done on a kind of, you know, last minute order basis. And so people now are buying up as much as they can.
Later, our environmental reporter explains why birds look forward to spring as much as the rest of us do.
Plus, the Wisconsin premiere of a 1944 cabaret originally performed in the Terezin ghetto.
And the author of a new novel imagines the Happy Days characters as real people.
The fun part of the book is sort of remembering yourself watching the show and sort of what your life was like back then. You're remembering your own childhood. That was part of the project, reintroducing those memories to our lives.
Lake Effect is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for joining us today. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. March 29th was to be the day that Britain would leave the European Union, the deadline for what's known as Brexit. But the deadline has been pushed back to next week amid legislative wrangling over a deal that would govern how Brexit would work. 8 different options were debated and ultimately rejected by Parliament last week.
Political analysts say the odds are not good for the options being debated this week either. And so again, the UK could face a situation in which Brexit happens with no deal in place, or the deadline could be pushed back yet again. Reporter Claire Balderson has been watching the developments from within the UK. The former BBC correspondent and presenter joins us now via Skype. Claire, it's great to talk with you again.
Well, it's a great pleasure to be with you.
Well, I called you up for the very reason that we have just passed the big exit deadline. Wasn't Brexit supposed to happen on the 29th of March?
It absolutely was. March the 29th, 2019 was the date at which the UK was supposed to leave the European Union. And that's because exactly 2 years ago, that is when Theresa May, the Prime Minister, triggered Article 50, that complex piece of whatever it is, legislation, that says to the European Union, we're going to leave. And then you got 2 years to prepare to leave. And guess what? We got through those 2 years and we were not prepared to leave. There had been no decision on how to leave and on what then happens next, because it's very hard to get yourself out of this massive block where you've got trading relationships, financial relationships, you've got free movement of people. So you've got people from all different countries or living in each other's countries. You've got to get yourself out of it. And then once you've done that, discuss your future relationship. And that just didn't happen because nobody in the UK could agree on how it should happen and what should happen. So the deadline came and the deadline went. But it was allowed to pass because, guess what? We got ourselves a new deadline. The Prime Minister went to Europe and she said, having a little bit of a problem, we're trying to get our withdrawal agreement, as it's known. We're trying to get that through the House of Commons. We haven't done it yet. Give me a bit more time. So we've got a new deadline now. And that deadline is April the 12th. It's unlikely anything's going to change before April the 12th. So they might give us another deadline until May the 22nd. And so it goes on, deadline after deadline, and nothing changes.
The thing that just astounds me, looking at it from this side of the pond, is that nobody can seem to agree. It seemed when the vote, the referendum happened and the UK vote, well, not all of the UK, as we know, but, you know, the majority said we want to leave the EU, that at that point, somebody should have sat down and said, well, how are we going to do this? And it seems like nobody really did.
No, because nobody expected that that's the way the vote would go. And it was a very small majority in favour of leaving the European Union. The vote was only just won by the Brexit fans. And what that meant was that they hadn't really expected it to happen. They hadn't thought through a plan. But also, But it was never very clear during the referendum campaign what Brexit, as it's now known, leaving the European Union, would look like. No one actually said, and this is how we'll plot it. This is how we'll do that thing of extricating ourselves from the trading bloc. This is how we will reshape our relationship in the future. It was won on an awful lot of slogans about taking back control and Parliament will be in control and will no longer be dictated to by Europe. But there were no concrete factors in that about, well, how and what and why and all those things that we've now been talking about. And what happened after the Article 50 was triggered, that move to get yourself out of the European Union, when that happened, was that still nobody brought together big minds to think about this. And really what started to happen at that point was that everyone discussed it and began to give their pitch, their kind of idea of what they thought the relationship with Europe should look like in the future. And what emerged were more gaps, more divisions, more anger on each side, which means it's got more and more bitter as the months have gone on. And so that's why the divisions now are actually even bigger than they were in June 2016 when we voted on this.
What does the European Commission, what's their reaction to all of this? Are the Europeans sitting there looking at you going, well, leave already?
They are now. Yes, they weren't. I mean, for a long time, there was a lot of sympathy and a lot of tolerance in Europe amongst European heads of government, as well as at the European Commission, which sits in Brussels and which has been handling all the negotiations. And for a long time, there was sort of sympathy. OK, you've done this thing. It's a slightly shooting yourself in the foot kind of thing, but we'll help you through it. We'll negotiate in good faith. We'll, you know, try and get this resolved. But, you know, we've got to think about the 27 remaining countries as well. We can't just think about Britain. And they carried on in this sort of vein. And there was a lot of sympathy. But the point has been reached now where there's just exasperation. OK, we've given you an extended deadline. We have really tried to help you get this sorted out. And still, you are incapable of getting anything through Parliament in Britain. So what do you want us to do now? And it's got to the point where in Britain, people are saying, oh, well, we'll get another extension. Maybe we'll get a long extension. We'll get a year's extension. And Europe's starting to say, do you know what? Just go. We don't want it anymore. If it means you crashing out without a deal, no arrangements about what happens to trade on the day after you leave, we don't care. Just go. And there are some people in Europe, in the Commission perhaps a little bit, but particularly in various European countries, and President Macron in France is one of them, who is basically saying, we've got other things to think about. We've got to think about our relationship with Russia. We've got elections to the European Parliament coming up in May. We have to get on with sorting out budgets and a new president of the Commission and all these other things that Europe should be doing. We don't want to spend any more time on the UK and its internal problems, because this is really an internal British problem now.
What happens if the crash out happens? I mean, what does that mean? I guess people don't really know what that means.
No, yeah. No, they don't know. There's a lot of sort of concern and fear and a lot of stories in the papers about what might happen. There are reports that pharmaceutical companies are kind of hanging on to supplies of important drugs, stockpiling basically, so that they'll have enough for 6 months or however long if there is what they call a no-deal Brexit, no agreement on how to unwind the relationship, no transition period, no agreement on the future relationship, that crashing out you referred to, it's called a no-deal Brexit. If that happens, then, you know, what happens to sort of imports of not just foods, but medicines, as I say. One of the things people have been talking about is toilet paper. Apparently, we don't stockpile any in this country. It's all done on a kind of, you know, last minute order basis. And so people now are buying up as much as they can, just in case you're not going to be able to get it because we're not trading, we're not taking imports, or there are terrible, you know, long lines up at the customs and it's hard to get trucks into this country and all the rest of it. We don't know what will happen, but it will certainly be highly disruptive and probably quite damaging to the economy. And all the big sort of surveys that have been done by the government that have looked at this say it will not be good. And in fact, Parliament has voted that there must not be a no-deal Brexit. We must not crash out. The trouble is, it's not in their power to stop it because they haven't voted for what should happen instead. That's one of the crazy things. What's one of the, you know, the ridiculous situations we're in is that they've said, oh, yes, under no circumstances must we crash out. And they say, well, what will happen? We don't know. We can't agree. That's the problem.
What is the likelihood, whether it's a crash out Brexit, a no deal Brexit, or an ordinary Brexit, that once it finally happens, that Scotland is going to have another vote for independence? Because they were very strongly wanting to stay with the EU.
Yes, that is one of the unknowns, one of the many unknowns that is coming out of this. That Scotland has said all along, well, we didn't vote to leave the European Union because they didn't. Scotland and Northern Ireland, the majority was in favour of staying. It was in England and Wales that there were majorities in favour of leaving the European Union. So Scotland has said all along, we don't want to do this. And we're waiting to see what the UK comes up with in terms of its relationship with the European Union, a transition over the next couple of years, an orderly exit from the European Union, a future relationship. We're waiting to see what will happen on that front, because if we don't like it, then the most obvious thing for us to do would be to hold another referendum on independence. And there are strong indications that the separatists, the independence movement, might well win that. But we don't know that yet. It's a threat hanging over the UK. And it's just one of the things that make a lot of people here think that what Brexit might lead to eventually is actually the breakup of the United Kingdom as the UK. Because if Scotland leaves, then what happens with Northern Ireland, which has been quite an issue throughout this whole process? Because, of course, Northern Ireland has a border with Southern Ireland, which is an independent country in the European Union and is staying in the European Union. So what happens across that border? You can't put back what they call a hard border, where you have, you know, watchtowers and troops on the border and all the stuff that we had for many years during the Troubles in Northern Ireland. No one wants that again. So what happens to Northern Ireland? Would it then end up basically joining Southern Ireland? Would it leave the United Kingdom in years to come? Would Scotland leave? Would you just be left with England and Wales? Those are yet more questions that everyone asks. We have no idea at this stage. And the reason we have no idea is because we still don't know what the relationship between the UK, led by England, the biggest part of the UK, is going to be with the European Union in the future.
This might be a silly question, but...
No question is a silly question when it comes to Brexit.
Is it too late to revoke pulling the trigger on Article 50?
It's a very good question, and it's something that a lot of people are saying we should do. And in fact, there is a petition that's been submitted to Parliament, which is going to be debated this week, in which more than 6 million people have asked for exactly that, revoking Article 50. It is entirely possible to do that. You can revoke it up until the point when the final deadline passes. So at the moment, that deadline is the 12th of April, as I said. So before the 12th of April, we could revoke Article 50. We could say, you know what, European Union, we've got this all wrong. We need to start again. We still believe in that vote. The majority said they wanted to leave. We're still going to do it, but we need more time to really think this through. Because there's a lot of criticism of Prime Minister Theresa May. She is really universally felt to have handled this very badly, including moving to Article 50, informing the European Union that we were leaving way too early. She did it so that she could call a general election in the hope that she would increase her majority back in 2017. She didn't. She lost her majority. But it was a political move showing people that she was committed to leaving the European Union. But all it did was start the clock ticking. And then it's been a race ever since then to try and work out how to leave the European Union. So no, it could be revoked. A lot of people want it revoked, but there isn't much more time to do that. The other thing that people are asking for is a second referendum on the grounds that we didn't really know what the future would hold in terms of the relationship with the European Union. As I say, you know, no one sort of sat down and said, this is what the relationship will look like. This is what is going to happen. This is what Brexit will mean. And that a lot of people have changed their minds and a lot of things have changed since 2016. It's nearly 3 years since we voted. and that therefore we should have a second referendum. And that is one of the things now being discussed, but the Prime Minister is very much opposed to that. So there are moves that could happen that could stop Brexit, but we're getting very close to the wire now. It's almost too late to do that.
Even if those things happen, though, would the Europeans say, okay, fine?
I think at this stage, they would be pretty exasperated if we revoked Article 50 purely in order to buy more time and go on arguing about this with the prospect of the UK leaving the European Union still sitting there, hanging over everybody, being this topic that they just can't get away from. I think that would be irritating for them. They'd have to accept it because that's the rule.
I think if we were to have a referendum in which we reversed it, there would be some relief, but also a lot of anger. But bear in mind that Britain is one of the biggest economies in the European Union, and it is going to be damaging to quite a lot of our trading partners in the EU when we leave. And a lot of them, especially the smaller countries, would quite like us to stay. They also like Britain's sort of political influence in Brussels as well. It's going to be a mixed bag. Very much the feeling is just make up your minds. But, you know, if we decide we're going to stay, well, they have to keep us. They can't throw us out. And I don't think they'd want to, but they just want us to get on with it one way or the other.
So we've been talking about this from a policy standpoint. We've been talking about governments. We've been talking about trade. How are people feeling? That just the people on the ground, your average person on the street, what's going on as this drags out?
People are so fed up with the whole discussion about Brexit. And really, there's a lot of anger now directed at politicians about their sort of inability to compromise and to reach any decisions and to actually do something. And I think it's been damaging to democracy in that way, in that, you know, people are really sort of turning their back on the whole process and saying, well, they can't decide anything, they're useless. But there are some indications that it's really affecting the mood of the country, and that individuals are reporting being quite depressed or quite angry or anxious, actually, is the overriding feeling. And several BBC programmes have looked into this and been broadcasting interviews with people and discussing with psychologists the impact that this is having generally on people, who are reporting that they can't sleep, they wake up in the night worrying about it, they've become obsessed with it, or they can't bear to hear about it. It really is taking over our lives in a very big and, I think, rather damaging way. And a lot of people are just feeling, not only can we just get on with it, I'm fed up with it, it's boring, I don't want to hear about it anymore, but they're really beginning to internalize it and get quite anxious about it. And, you know, we do joke about things like stockpiling cans of tuna or toilet paper or whatever it is, but these are serious things. People are worried about the future. A mixture of anger, I think, and some depression and a lot of anxiety. And it really is affecting the national mood.
Claire Boulderson is a former correspondent and presenter for the BBC, who is now an independent journalist based in the UK. You can hear more of her conversation with us at WUWM.com.
We'll take a quick break, and then why birds are just as excited about spring as the rest of us are. You're listening to Lake Effect on WUWM. We are back with more of Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. After a chilly couple of days, it really is beginning to feel a bit more like spring. And we are not the only creatures who crave the season. So do birds, it turns out.
Their migration and nesting are woven into winter's transition into spring. Some listeners have been asking about birds, so WUWM's environmental reporter Susan Bentz takes wing and visits the avian world for this installment of Beats Me. That's a series which gives you the chance to ask the questions of our beat reporters.
I'm standing at what birders consider a hot spot, but looks like an unlikely avian oasis to me. It's a scrubby piece of land at the southeastern edge of Jones Island. That's located at the base of the Home Bridge within Milwaukee's Harbor District. Birds fly overhead and others plunk down into a sea of grasses and weedy plants. The only bird I can clearly identify is a red-winged blackbird. A listener wanted to know if owls migrate through this spot. Bill Miller, who heads the Western Great Lakes Bird and Bat Observatory, based north of Port Washington, has visited this spot.
We saw a lot of different species of owls come through that zone of wildlife habitat that was kind of accidental wildlife habitat.
Miller says starting in the 1970s, crews dredging Milwaukee's harbor to keep it open for commerce needed somewhere to go with the gunk.
After a few years, there was enough of it that vegetation built up on some of it. But then there was also an area of open water in the center and a muddy edge.
Miller has spotted snowy and short-eared owls here. Of course, Lake Michigan is an important flyway for many species of migrating birds. So the accidental habitat, Miller says, is great for birds whose migration spans hundreds and hundreds of miles in need of rest and refueling.
Of any single place of its size in the state of Wisconsin, more different bird species have been seen there than any other place by far. It's only about like 11 and a half acres, right? And over 300 species of birds have been seen there.
I sat down with Miller 30 miles north of Milwaukee at the UWM field station. It's surrounded by a habitat-rich network of wetlands and forests. His students are about to arrive for their weekly Introduction to Birdsong course. Miller wishes it were mid-May. This would be, he says, a great spot for his students to experience peak bird migration.
Where it's this mild night and we've had a warm day all day and maybe a southerly wind. The birds are 500 meters above the ground and they're all talking to each other. They're not singing, they're just giving contact calls. But you can hear a flock of 100,000 birds.
That number might seem enormous, but actually there's a big decline in birds in North America and around the world.
Globally, one out of eight species is threatened or endangered.
To try to turn the tide of decline, Miller is determined to pass along his love of birds' songs and their unique behaviors. Dusk is approaching as Miller guides the fledgling birders through some of the field station's habitat-rich areas. A sandhill crane swoops above our heads.
So you know that sandhill cranes have been in North America for 9 million years, way before any humans showed up here.
Nearby, another migrator who has settled in for breeding season, the woodcock, sounds off.
It's such a weird sound, you know? Kind of sounds like a little electronic toy. The woodcock is really showing off, hoping to, you know, kind of attract the attention of a lady.
Not far away, robins make what Miller says is their go-to-bed call.
Kind of like they just can't settle. I'm not ready to go to bed yet, Mom. It just proved me right.
Jackie Fulcomer knows the feeling. The busy parent of two lives a half-hour drive from here. Fulcomer seems to be savoring every sound and tidbit she learns about the birds around her.
So I wanted to learn, get more acquainted, come home and share with my kids, and then they listen, and we listen to bird songs together, and then potentially it all just trickles down, and together as a family we learn more.
Fulcomer's words, along with a surprise visitor.
And there's a song sparrow. So late in the day, that's amazing.
Phil conservationist Bill Miller with hope.
Watch what he does now.
For Lake Effect, I'm Susan Bentz.
Doesn't matter if you've seen it 10,000 times, it's still cool.
Don't forget, you can submit your own Beats Me story ideas at WUWM.com.
We'll take another quick break and then meet the creative team behind the local premiere of a 1944 cabaret that was originally performed in the Terezin Ghetto. You're listening to Lake Effect from Milwaukee's NPR.
La 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 la
Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. The story of the Holocaust is well known. 6 million Jews and several million gypsies, homosexuals, and others considered undesirable by the Nazi regime were murdered from the late 1930s to the mid-1940s. The horror of concentration camps such as Auschwitz is easy to see, if not comprehend. But while the mass exterminations were going on, another camp called Terezin inflicted a different kind of terror.
It was a so-called model camp that the Nazis used to show the Red Cross they were treating prisoners well. It was also a camp in which musicians, artists, and theater people were held in order to stage shows for visiting officials. It was in that camp where a cabaret called The Last Cyclist was created by an artist named Carl Schwenk in 1944.
More than half a century later, playwright Naomi Pates found the script, which had never been performed, and adapted it for the modern theater. She joins us on the phone now, along with the director of the Milwaukee premiere, Mark Bergers, and dramaturg Dan Humschild, who's a fellow at Milwaukee's Holocaust Education Resource Center. Pates explains how she came across the original script.
This has been a long process and a labor of love. My husband is a congregational rabbi, and our congregation snagged, for want of a better word, a teenage arts conclave, which was held every 4 years. And he chose as the theme the Jewish communities of various places. So it was the Jews of Morocco, the Jews of Renaissance Italy, the Jews of Soviet Union. And for this particular year, he wanted to do the Jews of Czechoslovakia with a particular focus on Terezin. And he came across in a book called Terezin, which is published by the Jewish communities of Bohemia and Moravia, which is the Czech part of what was then Czechoslovakia. There was a chapter on theater in Terezin, theater and cabaret. And in it was one paragraph description, a long paragraph, about a play called The Last Cyclist. It was the only description that was in this entire chapter. And she called it our most courageous production. And I wrote a minor script, if you will, to be done with narration and, you know, some oohs and ahs by chorus for this program. And it was very effective. It was powerful, even in its simplicity. And it stayed with me. I decided I wanted to find the play. We spent a lot of time going to the Czech Republic and have a number of friends there. And I alerted friends there that I was looking for the script. And a few years later, actually probably 2002 maybe, a friend who taught at Charles University found a script in the library of the Theater Institute in Prague. And it was in Czech. And it took a while before I had it translated. So it took another 2 years before I was able to get the script. When I got the script, I looked at it. It was in two acts at that point. At this point, my script is in one act. But the second act was radically different from the description in the book about Terezin, which was written in 1965. The same woman who wrote the chapter on theater in Terezin, she had been in Terezin. She was a survivor. She had been a member of the cast of that play. And she did from memory a creation of The Last Cyclist, which she wrote with a colleague who was the theater director of the Rococo Theater in Prague, an avant-garde theater. The woman's name was Jana Sherova, and she performed in the production. And as Mark knows, and as Dan knows, Jana Sherova appears in my play. She was probably the only survivor of the cast of The Last Cyclist. I needed to see if I could recreate as closely as possible the script that matched the description she gave. The original was totally and forever lost when Schwenk was sent to the East and died on a forced march just before the end of the war. I used survivor memories and drawings of costumes and sets that had been done by a man named František Zelenka, who was a prisoner in the camp as well. And slowly but surely, I constructed something that I thought would work. In order to make the play relevant and make it understandable to our audiences, our contemporary audiences, I created a framework, an introduction and a conclusion. The framework begins with Jana Sherova, who I wanted to give a great deal of credit to, and her recollections as an older woman. And then in the ballet version, it segues into the night of the dress rehearsal. And I'm not sure I mentioned earlier that the play was banned after its dress rehearsal by the Jewish Council of Elders. They managed the internal workings of the camp, the food distribution, the schools, at the behest of and as prisoners of the Nazis. They were terrified after the dress rehearsal because the allegory is very overt. Clearly, the lunatics are the Nazis and the cyclists the Jews. So I created that opening and then a closing which wraps around the end of the performance of the dress rehearsal.
Thank you, Naomi. That's perfect time to bring in our two folks here who are actually working on the production here. Mark, how did you come to know of this piece?
Actually, Dan brought it to me or to us at Cardinal Stritch. So in October of 2017, we had a meeting about the script and he kind of plunked it in front of us. And there was so much else going on at that exact moment. And I read the script and to me, I was like, whoa, this is really complex. The concept of this show and doing justice to all of the things that Naomi spoke about, as well as our pedagogy and our students, it felt like it was possibly too complex for just our students to do or to put on. So I kind of left it for a little bit and came back around to it, and we started these discussions, and we realized that if we could do a collaboration between our organizations and do something really unique by bringing professional actors and artists in to work alongside with our students, that we could really do a more expanded production process that lasted almost a year in order to really explore the play the way that it needed to be explored and then get it to a production and rehearsal standpoint, which is where we're at now.
And so, Dan, how did you find this play? Was this just part of research, interest in what was going on in Terezin?
Well, it all trickles down from Naomi originally. Mm-hmm. Naomi is friends with one of our board members, Betty, and Betty brought it to our attention in the first place. And that's where the seed of the idea was germinated initially. So it kind of was a trickle-down effect until it got to me. And then our partnership with Cardinal Stritch enabled me to take it to somebody who actually has a stage and has all the actors and has all the wherewithal and skill to actually bring this to life. Because if we were to try to do this on our own, I genuinely have no idea how we would go about doing that. And so when it came to me, it was an obvious opportunity to generate a really strong element within the partnership. And so we were just hoping that Mark would agree that this is a good opportunity to expand, hopefully, the offering in this year's slate of shows. And then when he came back to us and said that he was interested in it, then the partnership really grew. And I genuinely think that this is, so far at least, the pinnacle of the partnership between our two organizations.
Well, it's also theatrically so fascinating. I mean, anyone who knows anything about history of the Holocaust knows that Terezin was the model camp. Mm. It was the camp where they used to bring the Red Cross in to show that things really weren't that bad and everyone was treated well. And look, we have orchestras, and look, we have singing groups, and look, we have theatrics. Mm. And there are other pieces that have come from that time, from composers and everything. I had never heard of this. I didn't know anything about a cabaret. And you have to think, Naomi, like you were saying, the elders must have been terrified because this was such an overt slap in the face, mm-hmm. and a commentary on what was actually happening at the moment.
Absolutely. As you say, there were a great many performances of all kinds and thousands of lectures for which there is a book that lists not only the people who gave the lectures, but the titles of the lectures. In addition to The Last Cyclist, only one other production was banned, and that was an opera called The Emperor of Atlantis. And it also was so overtly anti-Nazi.
For the rehearsal process, Mark, how much history did you have to impart to your cast, particularly the younger cast? Was there a lot of that, and was Herc involved in that?
Yeah, I mean, that was the big, not necessarily fear, but the big challenge for the whole process was that there is so much history and so much specific. And as theater artists, we want specificity and focus. You know, it's not October 1956, it's October 15th, 1950, whatever, you know, those things are for theater. So we had a really good opportunity to work with Herc and Dan to get a lot of historical information, especially for our younger cast members and our production team. So we'd been meeting for over a year. We've gotten the chance to listen to a few Holocaust survivors speak. We've had a lot of information brought to us and research from Naomi and Dan and other sources that we've imparted to the cast since they were cast. What's been a challenge is that we have to balance the idea of how much is this a historical representation of the Holocaust down to who we cast, what they look like, what their ages are, etc., and how much of it is a homage to the artistic spirit of those people in creating this art, this artistic artifact, or what I like to call like a political cartoon, or like she says, an allegory. And that has been really interesting. So our cast does not look like the people who were necessarily, we don't know exactly who was in it. So we have to make that choice of how historically accurate are we trying to be and how much are we performing an artistic production?
Right. I was going to say that balance between is it a museum piece,
right,
or is it a vibrant, you know, current piece of theater? And you have to kind of honor, you know, both the history,
right,
but also, you know, this is a modern audience that's mm-hmm. seeing this, and we are how many decades removed now? I imagine it's a tough one. It's a
yeah.
tough balance to strike.
It ends up being both. I mean, that was our large discussion with Dan, with Naomi. I asked her in my casting, can I cast diverse ages, backgrounds, etc.? And once we went down that road, we had to accept the fact that we were also going to be using our own artistic talents and backgrounds the same way that they did. And to me, that makes this production out of the highest respect for those great artists who created this piece, which is really intricate and interesting and multi-layered and fascinating. So that's kind of where we went with it.
Mark, let me ask you a question.
Ooh.
I've found over the years of this being done in colleges and high schools by professionals, by the amateurs, a remarkable thing that I had not anticipated, which is that the cast of in each place, whatever their age is, has gotten remarkably involved in learning more and more about the history. One woman said to me, this is why I went into theater.
Mm-hmm.
It was for, you know, for things like this. And another person said, when I complimented them on their performance, we didn't do this for us. Mm-hmm. We didn't even do it for you. We're doing it for them. And have you had that kind of a response?
100%. Anyone who has involved in the Milwaukee theater community, if you take a look at our cast list, the cast is full of amazing mm-hmm. actors, and all of them in the audition process. The amount of emails that my casting director and I got during the audition process just saying, like, thank you for calling me into this. I did all this research. It's so interesting. I mean, they're great artists, so they do research anyways, but everyone mm-hmm. has seen this project as extremely special. And I think it's been really interesting for my students because to them, this is just another show. I mean, it's not just another show, but it's one of four shows in a season, and they're all working on all four
mm-hmm.
shows. And I don't think they understood until they got into the rehearsal room just how different this project is. I'm unable to do the amount of research to encompass all of the things we could learn about this. So the actors have brought so many things into rehearsals and told me facts I didn't know, or pieces that they found when they were researching a character like their own, or in Laura Monagle's case, actually researching Yana. And it's been absolutely amazing.
Dan, as you have been involved as self-appointed producer, is that what you said?
That's just what I call yes. myself to my friends. So
yes.
they're very impressed.
And as dramaturg, are you impressed with what the students are bringing to this and what the cast in general is bringing to this?
Absolutely. I was brought in as the dramaturg and as kind of the resident expert. And I'm very, very happy to say that the students have exceeded the master at this point, it seems like, because I kind of provided them with a number of different avenues for exploration. And our organization did, you know, provide the link to the Holocaust survivors that they've had a chance to bear witness to. But the cast and the crew and everybody on the true production squad has done a remarkable job of really, really digging in and exceeded all of my capacities tenfold, which is precisely the kind of thing that we were hoping would happen when we brought this production to Cardinal Stritch. And in fact, it's kind of spilled out of the theater and into other realms as well. For example, some of the students who are affiliated with Mark's program and are also interested in fine arts have created their own student-generated and student-curated art gallery that is responding to The Last Cyclist, and that'll be opening the same week as the play in the space directly adjacent to the theater. And this is exactly the kind of thing that Herc was really hoping to have happen, is that this would be an educational opportunity to the utmost degree, that students would really take the reins and feel empowered to discover for themselves what this play is about and what it means to them in the modern day. And they've really done that to an incredible degree.
Is there any idea, once this production specifically is over, of taking it around Wisconsin or taking it elsewhere, even just locally?
Now there is. Thank you for the idea.
Because I'm thinking there's an awful... I mean, Naomi's used to having it produced around the country.
Right.
But, you know, there's been such a collaborative spirit in what you're describing to me. It sounds like it would be something that would be worth taking on the road, as it were.
I think it definitely would. I mean, I'm really interested. I often think of theater as being the beginning of a discussion or a continuation of a discussion, and I usually try not to answer the questions for the audience but pose them. So I'm very interested to see what the reaction from the audience is, what they pick up from the piece, and what we think will be a very complex and layered response to the piece. So I think it would have legs for sure around the country.
Naomi, I want to thank you so much for joining us by phone. And Dan and Mark, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you so much, Bonnie.
Thank you.
Thank you for including me.
Naomi Pates adapted the script for The Last Cyclist by Carl Schwenk. It's directed by Mark Burgers, co-chair of the Performing Arts and Theater Program at Cardinal Stritch University. Dan Humschild is Holocaust Education Fellow at HERC, the Holocaust Education Resource Center in Milwaukee, and serves as dramaturg for the production.
Pates will do a Q&A session following Thursday's premiere at the Nancy Kendall Theater at Cardinal Stritch University. Performances will run through the middle of April.
We will take one more quick break now, and then a new novel featuring some old characters. What if the Happy Days characters were real people who existed in the real world of 1980? East Milwaukee. That question answered when Lake Effect returns on WUWN.
Sunday, Monday, happy days. Tuesday, Wednesday, happy days. Thursday, Friday, happy days. The weekend comes, my cycle hums.
Back now with more of Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Plenty of TV shows and movies over the years have been the subjects of fan fiction, and many of those adaptations take the characters as they are and place them in plot lines their original creators never dreamed of. James Boyce's new novel is not exactly that kind of fan fiction.
Who Killed the Fonz places the characters from the iconic Milwaukee-based sitcom Happy Days a couple of decades after the series ended its run. It imagines Richie Cunningham, Patsy Weber, Ralph Malph, and others existing in the real world of the 1980s following a tragic motorcycle accident on the Hone Bridge. The book is set in a somewhat fictionalized version of Milwaukee, far from the real world of Jersey City, where we reached the author by phone last month. James Boyce, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So why was Happy Days the show that inspired you to get going down this road and write this book?
A few reasons. Happy Days, it has its own place kind of in our culture. We sort of know the world. We know the characters. Everybody knows Fonzie. It's sort of an iconic piece of American culture. But the interesting part about Happy Days is not many people really know that many or remember that many details about Happy Days. But we kind of, you know, there's a few plot lines, I guess, but over the course of 10 years, the plot lines kind of fall away and the details of certain elements of the show fall away. What you're left with is an iconic character in Fonzie and this memory of this world that is full of nostalgic virtue and is sort of a happy place to return to. It's almost a misremembered past. It's sort of a version of a time and place in America that never really existed, but that doesn't really matter to us because we enjoy the memory of it anyway, the sort of imagined memory. And and then we sort of carry that pleasant feeling with us as we remember ourselves watching the show and go forth from there.
I was just gonna ask that, whether our memories of the show are as much about our memories of ourselves as they were about the show itself.
I think that's exactly right. The fun part of the book is sort of remembering yourself watching the show and sort of what your life was like back then. You're remembering your own childhood. That was part of the project, was reintroducing those memories to our lives.
Without giving too much away, give us a quick thumbnail sketch of where these characters, where you believed these characters or decided these characters had gone since their run on ABC ended.
Well, we sort of had an indication based on the end of the TV series. The last episode, Richie says goodbye to Fonzie, and he's going to Hollywood to make it as a screenwriter. That's kind of how we leave Richie Cunningham. If you sort of draw an extension from that, he goes to Hollywood right when the 70s is starting to happen. If we're working from the timeline of the TV series, so you can picture him there with the new Hollywood kind of movement happening, where we have Spielberg and George Lucas and the auteurs starting to take over Hollywood. So how's this wholesome Mr. Everybody's Favorite Son kind of fit into that when the Hollywood culture is working in shades of gray and moral ambiguity? He's a smart, sort of cultured, intelligent writer. He has, strong principles and ethics. And so I think he would probably fit in pretty well there. And what he has sort of turned himself into to do what his dream is, it transforms him. And when he comes back to Milwaukee 20 years later, he's unrecognizable, and it's alienating to those he left, who haven't been out there in Hollywood and don't understand why he has become like he has. And part of the book is him dealing with that and coming to terms with who he has become, who he used to be, who he's going to be. And his friends and loved ones sort of reacting to that and coming to terms with that as well.
Right, because back into Milwaukee, he kind of parachutes for Fonzie's funeral. I don't know that we're giving too much away, because the title of the book is Who Killed the Fonz, but he encounters Potsy and Ralph Malph, who have changed very little.
They've changed very little. They've stayed in Milwaukee, and they've had families and taken local jobs and are sort of living the life that they're on track for when he left them. So he's gone one way, they've gone another way. And a lot of the story is sort of reconciling that gulf between these old friends.
Right. And of course, some of this is, I think the timeline is a little complicated because the show was set in the 50s. But of course, it really transpired in the 1970s and 80s. Did that complicate things at all for you? Because a lot of what took place in the show did so really with kind of 1970s sensibilities.
Exactly. It was sort of thread the needle in terms of tone and voice. It would have been fun to kind of get very meta with it and have him sort of rubbing shoulders with, this young filmmaker named Ron Howard or something. getting very, very bizarre with it. He could be watching Happy Days or something. sort of toyed around with these ideas. But the project turned out to be capturing the voice of the show and adding literary value to the show, to the voice. Sort of taking this ephemeral piece of television and sort of trying to elevate it into something with substance, with literary value.
And still sort of maintaining that kind of inherent sweetness that existed in the show and with the characters.
That was really important, which we sort of realized drafting and sort of working on it, was how important that was. Once you took that out, the thing, it just sort of fell apart and wasn't Happy Days anymore, and wasn't really anything that we remembered or we definitely learned sort of the importance of the sweetness.
There's of course a mystery in this book, but really it seems like at the heart of things you're exploring the nature of friendship, really.
Exactly. The theme of the book, I think, is the nature of friendship. What happens as we grow up and grow apart geographically or, you know, spiritually or other ways? What happens to those friendships? And do those friendships still have value, and do they serve us, and how do we sort of bring those on and as we go forward? One of the most iconic friendships in Happy Days in American culture, I guess, is Fonzie and Richie Cunningham. We sort of grew up with Happy Days, and we sort of grew apart from Happy Days as we grew up, and Richie grew up with Fonzie, and he grew apart from Fonzie as he grew up. We grow apart from our pasts, sort of as a culture. What do we do with that past that we sort of are still dragging around kind of behind us? It hasn't really gone anywhere. It's still there. So how do we reconcile it, and how does it serve us, and how do we serve it?
Well, and it seems like the era in which you set this book is key, because any later and you get into the social media era, and it seems like friendship might have been a different animal if, you know, they had been able to track each other down over Facebook or Instagram.
It would have been a lot shorter book.
Maybe this gets heavier than we want to, but in some ways this book and using Happy Days, this is kind of a metaphor for our younger selves as people or even as a culture.
Yeah, that's definitely how I saw it as I was working on it. And that was definitely the goal, was to kind of explore that. I think that's kind of what makes it literature, is exploring that kind of idea. It gets to the sort of the human experience. That's a vital part of it. Growing, changing. So taking something that's, you know, seen as kind of this kind of goofy, lowbrow thing, an old TV show, and sort of exploring that sort of fuller aspect of it. That's really what sort of motivated the project and pushed it forward.
At the same time, it had to be something of a delicious exercise to take these characters who, you know, already existed in our, you know, in our sort of collective imagination, and do this hypothetical with them.
Yeah, it was delicious fun. That's how I'd say. it's appropriation art.
Do you have qualms about that as a writer?
No, it's interesting to me. I'm a fan of appropriation artists. Folks like Warhol or Richard Prince. Yeah, that's exciting to me, because I can get heady about it, but I think culture is so dominant in our lives that our relationship to it has value in exploring and portraying in art and literature. So playing with that was pretty meaty and juicy and just fun. You know, a lot of this book is fun. It's a lot more fun than other books I've done. Other books I've done are very, very, tend to be, gritty realism, I guess would be the way to put it. But this is a fun, page-turning novel.
Well, listen, James Boyce, I enjoyed it a lot. Thank you so much for taking a few minutes to talk about it.
That was my pleasure.
James Boyce is the author of the new novel Who Killed the Fonz, as well as four previous novels. He's also an occasional contributor to publications such as Esquire, Salon, and McSweeney's. We reached him on the line from New Jersey. And that is today's edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Thank you so much for tuning in today. And I sure hope you'll listen again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Fresh Air is next, so stay tuned. It's 11 o'clock.